the Honourable Albert Wright. Members, there are just a couple of points one would like to refer you to in the report that is for us. One of them was to do with imports and exports, in which we refer to our policy. I'm just taking some of the general points that have come to my attention, in which we ask Ms. Herling, you try and get the import figure at the time. When we talk about our policies, etc., and possibly some of the changes in manufacturing, not yet being able to achieve some of the export figures we want. We want to see what it is we were importing to get the net balance here. Now, we don't have that yet, you know. The only other thing that I'm aware about is the issue around which you raised with me, that Honourable Swing raised, who asked not to have percentages with respect to certain agricultural figures. We tried to get that, but without success. Am I right, Ms. Herling?
Chair, I did get a few figures, but not for South Africa. They were indicated on page 8, footnote 12.
All right. So we're not going to, notwithstanding that, you know, we do know Honourable Swing has tried to get this, or get us to get this through Ms. Herling, but we haven't been successful in that particular regard. Then when we get to page, I'm hopefully on the same page as you, that's what worries me, because I don't think I am on the same page, was the process followed here. I indicated that we wanted to use this trade report in the same manner that we were using the, that we had used other long reports. One of them in particular was the one on admin prices as steel, etc., in which we continued it into the new year, some of you will recall. But we produced an interim report, as it were. But the only thing is, next year, it seems unlikely that we will have an extensive meeting on trade. And I'm looking at the Honourable Debbie in the slide. But we may make a reference to it. So when we close off now, the thing is we're unable to indicate where we are on some of the SADC protocols, for example, because they go until next year, you see, and we're going to get that feedback from the Minister in this regard, you know, towards the middle of November, you see, and we don't have that information yet either. The other one that we don't have information on is the one along the, you know, the Doha issues themselves and different points that were made in respect of the regional integration. One of the statements made in that regard was along the lines of South Africa, you know, that the EU did not pose a threat to South African trade and interests. And I'm going to come to my actual copy. Unfortunately, I've been brought the wrong copy. So I'm talking from my notes now and not the actual copy itself. Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, thank you. In terms of the process, and just as having quickly skimmed through this document, which, well, I don't think it's grown like Topsy. I think it's grown with great orderliness, but it did start as two or three pages, and now it's quite a lot of pages. But then I see the headline of this, or the heading, is it's our attempt to do an oversight from 2009 to 2013. And from what you just said, because we won't have an entry next year, it's actually going to be 2014. So it's a serious document, Madam Chair. Now, the process, and you just mentioned the Doha round, and in a sense, how long is a piece of string? I mean, how long, what are we going to include in this thing, but what should we not include? One, and I like they've started using this word lacuna. It's a great Latin word, actually, but it's basically a gap. or the absence of. So, but there is a gap, as I see it, in terms of policy, and I don't know, one talks here of the TSFS, or the South African Trade Policy Strategy Framework, that's paragraph 2 on page 6. But Madam Chair, we've now suddenly got a new bill coming on trade. We're unilaterally cancelling, or they will still be in place for a few years, trade agreements with people that have been in place for years, but there's not one mention of it in this document. And I mean, it's quite a radical departure, but we can debate whether it's going to impact us badly or not. But I mean, it's a huge issue in our trade relations, and I do think it must become a lacuna.
As a matter of fact, yes, whenever I see the word lacuna, knowing it is Latin, nevertheless, I still think of lagoons, but which is why I don't tend to use it that much myself. But I take your point. With respect to bilaterals, let us not forget, and I know you've been in the committee for some time, when we had a meeting dedicated just to bilaterals, how do we understand this, 2 years ago, that was long before the not cancellation, the non-renewal of the future, not renewing. Not renewing something is not the same as cancelling it, you see. And it was explained very carefully there, the difference between a bilateral treaty and others. Now, we don't have a bilateral treaty with the United States, as you know. And yet, with many other countries, in particular Europe, can we put it that way, the different countries there, people sign up these bilaterals with us. And you will recall, when were most of these bilaterals signed and offered? They were done so, you know, in the euphoria of freedom. That's when it was done. Where we were made all these offers, and it was, let's sign a bilateral in this regard. And at that particular time, as you're well aware, we hadn't got developed the new trade policy, or even the framework. We hadn't got it. So a lot of this was done, still informed by the Uruguay round. We were telling everyone how developed we were. And we demanded to be classified in certain things, not this dispensation, may I add, the previous one. Of course, we woke up to the fact that we were still not quite there and needed to be reclassified. In the light of that, these bilaterals, though, at the time were signed, and it actually meant that the productive investment that would come into the country could be pulled out at a moment's notice. You didn't have to go on informing people and say, we are going to pull out our money. You did it. You did it. It was like hot money. It was got too hot for your hand, you threw it out. You sent it to another country. Now, I don't think there's anyone in this room that likes the idea of money going in and out that quickly, and I'll tell you why. It destabilizes our economy. Now, whether you are on the left economically or the right economically, one thing is clear. Hot money destabilizes an economy. That is a reality. So we didn't want to, in the middle of a bit, say, we're cancelling this, we're doing that. We honor our international agreements. Secondly, our bilaterals protect your investment for a further 10 years, unlike a lot of other bilaterals. And thirdly, in this particular direction, there isn't a businessman in this country that doesn't want to see a stable economy and promotion of productive investment. I'd be the first to say that there will always be issues within the bill, possibly, the new year coming before us, that we may need to tighten up as a committee. But if you look at the principle involved in the promotion, the protection and promotion, or promotion and protection of investment, then without a doubt it is an improvement and it's in the right direction. And that is why countries like France and the Netherlands, they welcome this. They don't have a problem. What's the problem with the others? Are they, you know, too immature economically to understand that this is not even in their own interest? It's not in their interest at all. Yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I mean, I'm hearing your arguments. I don't want us to argue about the merits, and I mean, I take your points. I'm a bit ignorant on all the issues, but the point is, I still think if you're doing an oversight report on trade, we should mention that there's a process going on, and obviously there's a bill coming where one will debate those issues. I don't think it's appropriate. I mean, I listened with great interest to what you had to say, but I don't think that's what we want to put in the report. I think we just want to report that we are now busy not renewing bilaterals, and we're doing this and doing that. And so, and there's a bill coming to this House.
Well, this is why it's in the report, and I didn't personally raise it, because it's been there. You know, we made a reference to this at the last time we tackled this. When was last time?
Which page?
It's page 14. So, in effect, it came from this committee, from the ANC, that this should be factored into the report. Exactly the point you're making. Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
And you'll see that it doesn't have my statements here at all, because it's not my report, it's the committee report. Honourable Khadebe?
I was just going to highlight that the issue of peace is part of the report. That's what I wanted to alert you to. And then the issue of the investment law is very critical. You go to Brazil. That's why when you invest in Brazil, you not put your money today, next week you take it out. Usually there's a time frame whereby when you put a certain amount of money up in excess of a certain value, it must be in the country for a certain period of time. So it is normal. Because you know that the Asian Tigers were brought down by George Soros, I don't think that we can afford that as a country.
Thank you. I think you've expressed it in a very balanced manner, Honourable Khadebe. And that's what informed us putting it in before. All right. I just thought I'd highlight those one or two things. The other one, I just let Ms. Herling recall here, is this one that... the committee which we asked to be factored in is the failure. Where's this? I wonder, Honourable Khadebe, if you just refer me to the area where we spoke about the manufacturing, etc., and that being somewhat of a problem. Ms. Herling? Last night we discussed it. You didn't? Yeah. All right, let's leave it. I'll come to it. I just thought it would help Ms. Herling to have tackled those issues first, the one on imports and exports, etc. All right, on page one, I want to take account of what Honourable McIntosh has said. You've missed some of the meetings, so you may not have always just got all the inputs from the committee, not simply the ANC across the board. But there was the agreement that we need to look back and capture it using the very latest information, and we were hoping the minister would join us, if you recall, last week. Fine, that didn't happen. So that was why I raised the point of static, etc., etc. Having said that, we can still continue with this. We do have sufficient, and bearing in mind, I'm also looking at Ms. Naidu, that does seem fairly unlikely that we're going to hear something earth-shattering from the Minister in terms of progress in this direction. I'm sure you all know that with respect to FARCU. Those formula are still being worked on. But what I wanted to ask you here is on page 2, I hope I've got the same page too as you've got now. We spoke about the challenges facing South Africa, and we said we need to indicate the focus on encouraging beneficiation. That is there as well now, you see in the second paragraph, all right? The one criticism I had, and it is a very small criticism, is when I saw the graph here at the bottom, a very good graph, South Africa's growth in GDP and in exports. I say to myself, now, where is this explanation? 1, 2, 3. if we go to the third paragraph here, is that right, Ms. Hurling? I hope you're following with me there now, and we've got the same document. Global trade. Page 2, third paragraph. All right. And you're looking at South Africa's growth in GDP and in exports. All right. Most European countries, et cetera, et cetera. And then it shows, nevertheless, concerns with regards to growth and trade remain. South Africa, the largest economy in Africa by GDP, showed positive signs for both economic and trade growth in 2010 and in 2011. Okay. However, economic growth in 2012 was not as good as expected. It's reflecting on this graph. What is useful is for those of us who, I suppose, you could say are a little bit meticulous here and there, it is put as reflected in figure X. You know, whatever figure X is, which is figure 1 in this case. Okay. Can you see that there? It's on that. But I think you've got to explain, Ms. Hurling, where this red is. Can you see it's below the line? You can't just say, what did you put here was not as good as expected. Do you see what I'm getting at? You're below the line. Are we looking at the same graph?
Yeah.
I know we can, but we must try to reflect in the text what is here.
I would say in 2012 economic growth was poor.
And we need an explanation for it. What is the reason? Because it does a massive pickup, and we all know the reason. I would hope we all know the reason. What was the reason for that? It was the whole commodity issue and the currency. You see,
I think Kasatu made a big contribution.
No, let's not go down that street. Yes, Honourable Mabasa.
Comrade Chair, you are going to have to bear with us. It's time Member McIntosh goes for Kasatu or for the party. I'm going to be on the opposite side. So I think to have tranquility, we will shake hands over tea. But we're not going to let him get away with this Kosatu thing all the time.
Honorable James.
Chair, I think you're quite right. I think that what should happen is on that line, it should simply refer to C figure 1.
All ready to rest there, okay? And then can we please go to page 3. I'm not going into every paragraph. I hope you'll trust me sufficiently to know if you yourself have gone through this. I'm trying to alert you to some of the points. The last paragraph. I mentioned imports. Do you remember that issue earlier on the balance? While there have been significant gains from IPAP in the past few years, page 3, stabilizing the manufacturing sector, there's the gains. These have not really translated into increased exports. The issue is, and I said this right in the beginning, we can't say this without getting the recon. The imports and the exports. And what are the imports in that period? I don't know. We're seeing that bad, okay? I don't recall it as such. South Africa's exports still dominated by exports of mineral products, natural or cultural pearls. What? A cultured pearl. What have cultured pearls got to do with it now? Is this an express? Are we now focusing on cultured pearls? Honourable Kadebi.
Chairperson, I think that paragraph, as you correctly said, that it must be balanced. Because definitely, when coming to the issue of the auto sector, we are still a big global player. We are still a big global player. I think that from what we have done through the industrial policy action plan. That's why the Mercedes-Benz plant in the Eastern Cape remains the best plant in the home of Mercedes-Benz. So those things, Chair, must be acknowledged. Because, yeah, they must be acknowledged. Né? So we cannot say that it didn't. Because when you look at that, Chair, all the C-class Mercedes-Benz all over the world, they are supplied by a plant in the Eastern Cape. So I don't understand when you say that you just have been translated in increased exports. Because definitely they was that. And then in the process also, because of our increased manufactured goods, I think that the issue of imports have gone down. They didn't go. No, whereas before, it was the balance was, yeah, the balance was, there was no balance. I think that we have rectified that, Chairperson.
Another closer look there in that paragraph particularly, and to look at broader context of this issue during this period. Remember, I know your stats will go up to 2012. I'm aware of that. However, remember, we're in 2013, the end. What is the SARB third quarter or second quarter saying? You know, the quarterly report of the South African Reserve Bank. What does that say, Honourable Khedebe Mkhwebase?
No, Chairperson, I fully agree with what Honourable Khedebe is saying on our auto sector, and I think we need to factor that in, especially because the local content, I think we have scored quite big on that. But I think what we need to also highlight, which I think is in line with that part of the paragraph, is that on beneficiation, particularly in terms of the commodities, we have not yet reached a stage where we could say we are exporting value-added goods. You know, if you talk of diamonds, gold, iron ore, that kind of stuff. Yes. I think there we must say that we need to put a lot more effort in order to increase our exports, value-added exports on the commodities.
I think we're hearing what you're saying, that there is a need for that, although we acknowledge the designations for localization have contributed. Honourable McIntosh?
That paragraph at the bottom, point three, I think the first sentence is fine, while there have been significant gains from IPAT in the past 2 years. That next sentence is really puzzling to me. I mean, I had no idea we were exporting natural cultured pearls. I mean, I know we have abalone farms, Ebermanis, and there's something, in PE, but I'm not aware of that. And it is minerals, products, precious stones. I think you need to say South Africa's exports are still dominated by exports of mineral products, full stop. We know that, to semi-precious stones. If we're going to talk about adding value, that's now another thing. And in fact, there's a lovely model of that in Gaborone, where the Botswana government have done an amazing, but against public-private partnership. It's with De Beers, and they're actually now starting to sell diamonds into the world markets out of Gaborone, which I think is a major achievement. But that's, I don't know, if the cultured pearls, that's great. That'll create jobs, because it's a lot of work to raise oysters. So I think we should scrap that piece.
I raised that because it alarmed me about the cultured pearls. I'm going to the cultured pearls with both Ms. Hilling and Ms. Magalani to sort out who put in cultured pearls and where these are. We don't want to see any cultured pearls here. No. There may be the odd little dam somewhere where they're cultivating something. I want to move to the purpose of this report. Honourable James.
I would only agree to take it out even as significant. I mean, I have no sense of what the significance of those exports are. I mean, yes. So, I mean, you know, it's not... We ever put it in there.
No, Honourable James, I can assure you, it is so insignificant, I'd have to get a better calculator. Please. And I want someone here in research to dispute that. Well, what are the percentages, this high percentage of money we're getting for exporting cultured pearls? No, personally I think there's some anomaly here. And that's, I'm going to leave it at the word anomaly. Process followed. Process. Can we focus here on the purpose? 1.1 on page 4. 1.1. Now, in that paragraph, it says here about creating a better world, etc., by building a new and improving existing trade and investment. Right, that's it. But somewhere along here, I've noted harmonization of business relations within Africa itself, intra-African trade. We may want to look at that issue. Made a note there. I hope Ms. Hurling, you just getting that in your mind. But I'm not looking at the next few pages. It's just technical. Until you get to page 8. Page 8. It's the non-tariff measures. Now that is something I'd like the content specialist, the research specialist, researcher to get their heads around. It refers to Jakarta, one of the incidents where South Africa has lost market access due to non-tariff measures was the closure of the port of Jakarta in Indonesia. All fruit exports to Indonesia were blocked unless the country's food safety control system had been recognized. Now we need to know what the situation is. This press says, page 8, is expected to take up to 3 years, as about 17 other countries were applying simultaneously and each had to be visited before recognition was gained. We're looking at the bottom of the page 8 there. Furthermore, Indonesia has implemented import quotas on certain products, including table grapes, etc. Now, why is this important? It's important if you consider that the European Union market of importing our fruits, you know, is also proved now challenging and problematic. So, you see, on the basis with both of these, we begin to experience a problem if we're also going to have something in Indonesia. Now, I don't know. If, you know, we've made a bold statement here, but what I have a problem with, having said this, there's no way that we're linking the two. We're linking it here now as we talk. We're not linked in the report. What's the impact of this for our fruit in South Africa, the exports? It's a serious one. Very serious. Look at the fruits it's trying to block. Do you see that there? It's citrus. Here's Honourable Abasa.
I'm just speaking on seeking clarity, whether the word recognized, is it the best word that we can use there? The one that says all food exports to Indonesia, and then it ends with recognized, the sentence is not quite clear, so I'm asking myself whether we can make it more clearer. Recognized, subjectively, objectively, you know, is it Indonesia, is it us?
Ms. Hurling, I think the issue here is, what do we mean by this term, you know, that none of this, where was this, unless all fruit exports were blocked. Okay, that's clear. Unless the country's food safety control system had been recognized, had been an official recognition, what is it? Have they actually got to put a stamp on? How do they show they've recognized it? Because, you know, for many of us from this point, what do we mean when we say we've recognized you? We've recognized this. What does it mean? paperwork, stamp, none of that?
As far as I understand, based on my discussions with the lady from AgriSA, the recognition basically would have to be that, for instance, like when we export it to EU and you're doing a, say, for instance, meat, so then the abattoir needs to be recognized by the EU, so it's got to meet certain standards. So it's not to say that Indonesia imposes a system, but they need to acknowledge that your system is sufficient and meets the SBS measures. So it's a, so therefore the visit to actually check it's in your paperwork that you actually do meet those criteria.
That makes it a little bit clearer, you know, in the report. Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, just to support what Ms. Herling said, I come from a town called Estcourt, which has produced the best pork sausages made in South Africa for about 50 years. And they export to the EU. EU veterinarians come every 6 months to that abattoir. Almost every year they raise the bar. We couldn't slaughter sheep, we couldn't slaughter cattle, so it's a problem for us. So one of the nicest things is one of our farm workers' daughters works in the laboratory to get those, to get us to profit, because she's got a food technology diploma, thank you. And the point is, you know, I'm just reaffirming the fact that these phytosanitary hurdles, these countries increase them. And we've got this black spot problem with our citrus in Europe at the moment. So I don't want to, you know, perhaps remind us that it does happen to ordinary South Africans, even like me.
I think what I would like to see happening here, this is not, there is a wealth of information here, first of all. This is like a resource document, you know, without a doubt to Ms. Madalani and Ms. Herling here. But the issue is we're not, what is the word, integrating some of this cross-cutting information. It's all to do with non-tariffs, okay? But now, I'll say this for you, Honourable McIntosh, you highlighted one of the issues, the phytosanitary. That's what it is. So what is it in Europe, this black spot issue? What is it here? It's all the same thing under this broad heading, you see. And we're having to fight that on a number of fronts. I think that's the message that needs to come here. I don't know. I'm asking. This is our report. But we, you know, we're more familiar with it, but if somebody else picks it up, what are these messages you're trying to get across here? And I don't know if it was worthwhile to have simply put non-tariff barriers somewhere, pulled out, phytosanitary, alluded to that, just a paragraph. You've got this, you've got that, you've got the next thing. And it's here, that, and here, as an example. Do you see? It's not just here. Because then you get further on, you refer to the European Union. You get further on, you refer to something else. What is the message we want to tell our people out there about our challenges? What is it? It is that we have, to some degree, begun to meet the challenges of tariff barriers, but not non-tariff. And together, this is, and what are these non-tariff barriers? Our people don't always know. By our people, I mean the people of South Africa who don't sit in trade and industry. All right. So do we agree at least on that principle? Huh. Okay, then we can move. So I think, Ms. Herling, you capture what we're saying there. Kind of somewhere along the line looking at non-tariff, Mr. Herling. All right, there we move. Honourable Gaines?
If I may, this is getting back to your initial point about the meaning of that sentence that says all food exports to Indonesia were blocked unless the country's food safety consistency had been recognized. That's, okay, but that still needs attention because the way I understand it now, food safety, by the way, is not the same as food health. Right? Okay. So I think what it should read, all food exports to Indonesia were blocked unless the country's food and health food safety and health control system has been accepted as meeting standards.
Yeah.
But we need to say that. meeting their standards.
Of course, you do think of organized labor and so on and so forth. On page 11. Honorable Kogasa?
Yeah, Chair, I just wanted to check whether the issue relating to, or first, I think that we need to highlight that black spot issue with the EU as well. Including the challenge that we had previously when we dealt with the gambling, the African horse sickness, which affected our trade horses, but also the what's the thing that escapes my mind now? Our wine, the bulk export of our wine to that issue. What's this? Rift Valley? Is it the same? Yes.
With the wine issue.
And
we should never allow people to forget that wine issue. We are writing one. Honorable Khadebi.
Chairperson, since we are still dealing with agricultural issues, I think that the challenge which was faced by the hostage farmers must also be highlighted. Remember that bird flu issue. I think that we have to acknowledge that somehow it has hampered our export of hostage meat and product to the outside world, so that we look inside, inward towards ourselves, that we have put in place systems to ensure that these diseases do not move from one area to the other area. I think those are the things you must be there.
I think we're going to be capturing this as well. I'm glad to see we're all applying our minds here now, because it is our report. We want it to be more integrated in some of the key issues. You've then looked at, we did raise the whole poultry issue on page 10, if you recall, but that again is an illustration linked to tariffs, but not quite the same as non-tariff barriers. And what I think has to happen here, Honourable Ms. Herling and Ms. Madalani, is that when we talk of trade, what are the key issues that we've got to unpack? And one of them is tariffs, non-tariffs, you know, etc., and dumping, etc. Now, this is to do with the dumping, rather. And I think, you see, this is why that, and Ms. Herling, I want you to not panic about this now. I'm discussing ways and means of trying to facilitate a time issue here. Because the main thing here is not to go on an American tour, but rather to go on a South African tour of our topics. Meaning, you know, instead of drop here, I went to 20 countries, we say no, we're dealing with this issue effectively. So let's not rubber stamp this report out of existence. You just joined us, Honourable Hildes. Thank you. We got your apology. All right. Page 11. The Goldman Sachs issue. I thought, Honourable Mabasa, Honourable McIntosh, this is something that will add light on the whole subject of the issue of worker productivity. This is not a socialist report. I didn't think Goldman Sachs were, are they, Mr. Herman?
Madam Chair, my eldest son used to work for Goldman Sachs as a stockbroker. It's not a socialist one. In fact, it's a feather in our cap.
Well, it's good to hear those who stand on the other side making that statement. But you can see there, and I'm going to repeat it, however, Goldman Sachs showed that South Africa's per unit labor productivity has improved from 2002 to 2012 by 11% in terms of compound annual growth, and was the top third of growth markets according to this measure. And that is why I'm going to recognize that in a minute, Honorable Yolu. That is why I was concerned about that graph, which shows us, you know, the the GDP had set coming way down and indicating we hadn't done so well. And I pointed out, we usually say it's productivity, you know, worker productivity. And I'm saying, what was the reason? Why did it drop? Was it what Honorable James has been saying, the commodity issues, you know, what was it? Was it currency? Because it wasn't worker productivity. That's what I'm saying. Do you see? And I don't think we've isolated the issue. Honorable Hill Lewis?
Yeah, I just want to check what the wording means in terms of the compound annual growth rates. I mean, as I understand that, the way that it's worded at the moment is that there's been an 11% growth in productivity in that nine-year period. Does it mean that, or does it mean that it's an 11% per year?
Over the period.
Okay, over the period. That's how I read it, so I think it is probably worded correctly. You see, the key point to make then is, as admirable as an 11% both in productivity over 9 years is, inflation and wage growth has been much higher. So in fact, there has been a real decrease in productivity. And I think that's what that 11% shows.
Look, that he's not talking of, you're talking of real, not nominal. Yeah. And if you read that report, it's very valuable to read. I took the opportunity of reading it. Have you read it? Made a good study of it. You'll see exactly what he means there. And in fact, that increase, as he qualifies it in the report, did show up. And he raises the point himself. What is it? Is it inflation? What is the issue that you get? The differences reflected here. And we just say it's a strike, it's labor active, you know, etc. It isn't always. It's other issues impacting here. So I'm not suggesting it's one or the other. What I'm saying, Honorable Hildreth, is we are trying to simplify it, and it cannot be simplified. Honorable James.
We have to be really careful in how we deal with the number. The labor productivity figure that Goldman Sachs is put in a report has to do with two sectors of employment. So in private sector employment, it's true that labor productivity has gone up. There's no question about it. So the workers who are employed in the private sector are accounting for wage increases and inflation and so on. The number is a good number. But the number that's not good are the workers employed in the public sector. The labor productivity in the public sector is not a good figure. What you have here is average. So if you compare private sector employment to public sector employment, you will get different productivity figures. That's the first thing. But the effect of this is about labor productivity for those who are employed, is that in some circumstances where there has been job shrinkage, marginal job creation in some sectors, but we have not grown our labor market to the extent we possibly can. Under circumstances where those who are employed are very productive. So our workers in the private sector are very, very productive.
Well, I would not like to belabor the point. The reality is we did address the hemorrhaging in things like textiles during this particular period, and the auto improved. But we come back to the same thing I think I'm saying. We mustn't conflate these things. That is why it's important to give reasons for this, that there's a clear picture at the end of this. I don't want people pointing to this report and saying it proves X when it doesn't prove X, but rather that it gives them a better understanding of the dynamics of the trade and the economy itself and the challenges we face. And even though we face these challenges, there is the improvement. Do you follow? That is what we're all saying. We need to make sure the facts properly presented to give us that picture. That's all I'm saying. That's why I raised the label one, you know. But let's move to a little bit of English then. 15. An easier matter to resolve. Page 15. Right. Regional integration, our favourite topic. The TPSF purported to continue. Now, I mean, you know, when I hear the word purported, it takes me back to 50 years or so, Paul Port, etc. No, no, there's a proper English word, obviously, proper English word, but let's say what we mean here. Let's just say what we mean. Now, who's using this word purported all the time in their language? Are you, Honorable Kwabasa? One of your favorite words. Now, can't we rather just simplify this to say what we mean? Okay? Today's young economists would rather like perhaps something. The TPSF intention is to continue consolidating. You know, let's just simplify it, okay? Right. So it's just a small point. And then the main beneficiary in this area, what's that about here? That's in the second paragraph where you've got that point. Booster, etc. One of the key concerns was the terms on which free trade area in South in Africa was established. Yes, imbalanced terms. Now, who made this statement? Imbalanced terms may be destabilizing for Africa, especially if South Africa becomes the main beneficiary within this type of area. This type of area, see what type of area you're even talking about. That comes from the Portfolio Committee, we are saying, Trade and Industry 2010A. Now, if this is 2010A, I'm not sure what the A may stand for, but clearly we were crawling at this stage in the portfolio, and now we're close to sprinting. Can you just tell me what, you know, the A is?
It's a report on the South African Trade Policy and Strategy Framework.
That was when the policy framework came out. Now, I want you to look at that. And one of the dangers about statements like that is that when they are taken out of context, you then find yourself in difficulty defending them, although in context, there's not a problem. Do you see what I mean, Honorable Khadebe?
Chairperson, I think that the statement is trying to highlight the fact that South Africa is the one which is, there's a trade imbalance between South Africa and the rest of the region in such a way that South Africa exports the finished products. That's why that earlier even in our report, we recognize that. South Africa is having a trade surplus with Africa in particular when coming to beneficiary products. So I think it tries to highlight that. You know, but I think that in the process, we also adopted, the region also adopted the industrial policy that the region should, Africa should industrialize. But I think that even in the previous engagement, we highlighted the issue that when coming to industrialization, there must be complementarities between South Africa and other countries. So complementarities, that certain things we can produce a particular product, but the inputs to our project can be produced in another country, so that can stimulate that regional integration. I think that part must be captured here, so that it cannot be left like this, because if it is left like this, it looks as if there's nothing which is being done, whereas there's a lot which is being done. That's why that the study itself has adopted industrialization as the key policy. Sure.
I think, yes, Honorable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, look, this is a very important report. And regional integration has also not just trade implications, but it, in a sense, has socio-political implications. Not that it's our job to get involved in the politics, but I always remember that what eventually created Germany, because there never was a Germany, was the Zollverein. It was a customs union amongst the German-speaking states, and it eventually led, under Bismarck's leadership, basically, to create a German nation. Now, there is a sense where I don't think we really realize how much integration there is. I think if you're on Home Affairs and you happen to visit these border posts, Maseru Bridge or Komati Poort or Bike Bridge, you will actually see trading going on there, and mostly done by women, interestingly enough, at a huge level. Now, you know, my concern is that we don't need to have that as part of our agenda. We should have it in the back of our minds. And You know, there are friends I have in Lesotho. And they say, you know, Lesotho is just another province of South Africa. We all come and work here. We get educated here. My son is in the hospital in Bloemfontein, and he's always getting Basotho people into the hospital, which he deals with. Now, this is happening everywhere else. Swaziland, they have borders. They are going across and getting grants there. So what's happening, in a sense, de facto, we are creating not... we're creating a new state in South Africa, with ourselves being the kind of, as we say, they're feeding on the udder of South Africa. But it's mutual, Madam Chair, it's mutual. If you go to blocks of flats in Johannesburg, 80% of the people living in the flats in Hillbrow and Berea are Zimbabwean. It is. I can prove it to you. And so we've got what's happening in terms of regional integration. We're in a sense, trade and movement is making us a much bigger country. And I think we should just be aware of that, and I think it's a good thing. But trade and regional integration, and there's no doubt about it. And I mean, with due respect, I mean, people have had a lot of fun with Jacob Zuma saying, this is Johannesburg. But, you know, people who come from other countries come to Johannesburg because they see it as the leader. So we must just have that in the back of our minds, I think. I don't know how we apply it.
Look, it's great to hear your enthusiasm on this issue of regional integration. And you've said a number of points that need to be captured and are captured, but just in a different way in the report. I think the big thing here is no one would disagree that what we are talking about is complementarity. The whole of Africa is moving in the direction of industrialization, as you said. As you are saying, Honorable McIntosh, there is integration all the time. It's a permeable wall or border. There's no such thing as a concrete border or whatever anymore, or iron wall or whatever here. So what we need to ensure is that in this industrialization, product are complemented in other states as we develop this. So this imbalance terms, I want to just see a little, as you're doing here, I see Ms. Hurling banging out a little mini explanation. Do I see the word complementarities? Yes. And the development of regional, I like that, regional value chains. Now we're covered. Right. Then we move to 16, and I think that was just to the industrial partnership agreements, yes. The South African Development Community is a proper name, isn't it? Now, I'm saying this off at a tangent, but it is with great interest that I came across something registered through SIPCO with the name SABC. Now, if someone said to you, they're from SADC on the telephone, who would you think they're from? So for anyone sitting here, would you for one moment have thought this is an independent company here in South Africa? Is ADC. That's right. They called me too, and I made an assumption that they were the community, the development community. And I asked myself, in terms of SIPCO, I'm not sure that that is bona fide registration per se. Can I register myself as South Africa and run it as a company? Do you follow what I'm saying? I don't know. Don't think so. Okay. Southern Africa Customs Union. Page 17, you've got a few pointers there, but we've covered them. 18 at the bottom here, the FTA, and we were asking about an update, which I referred to earlier. 19, 20. Under 20, you'll see in between the tables or whatever the matrix is. It's got here, however, the following issue should be considered. an expanding regional trade. Do you see that, all of us? By 5 or 6 bullets. What is it? 4 bullets. Facilitation of trade beyond tariff liberalization. Non-tariff barriers, etc., etc., harmonization. Implementation of regional integration. That is overlapping membership and non-implementation of rules of trade agreement. The impact of TFTA, that is, how balanced will trade be, and will increased intra-African trade be facilitated? The capacity of trade, that is, productive capacity and buying power. These are the issues that we then considered in this report. And then at the end, when we come to the conclusion, the question remains is how effectively we've been able to respond to that. Okay? You'll see here now on page 22 another issue we raised, the end of the first paragraph just before point 4. The third summit towards the end of November 2013. We see that there, Ms. Garner. Is it Ms. Garner? Garner. Garner. Yes, have you got any information on that? Seeing as we're now, you know, about the 6th. The end of November, the third summit. Are you looking at the report that we're looking at?
I don't have a copy.
You don't have a copy. Well, look, I'm sure if you were asking, it's very important you have a copy, you know, just to make your notes. Otherwise, I'm not sure what you'll be telling the minister. So, right, please. Yeah, please, Ms. Garner, okay. Just ask if something we haven't given you one. It's important to have one, especially if you haven't been given one. Please try and get something for us from Ms. Hurling in that direction, all right? Page 23, the Doha Round. Page 24, it's a continuation in that situation. And 25, I thought that there was a point that needs to be referred to. When we talk of the SACU-India Preferential Trade Agreement, the question that arises, we are SACU, we're part of SACU. How does the agreement, you know, within our SACU partners, how does that relate to and harmonize with our BRIC arrangements? Somewhere we need to make a reference to that, either in 4.2.2 or 4.2.3 on page 25. Can we all see that? All right, we also have a separate trading relationship with India, as you know. Now, how is all of that aligned? Page 27. The EPAs. The EPA deadline is October next year, but what is the current state? We did have an initial report from Mr. Karim in this direction that there has been some progress in this regard. Did you refer to that particular meeting, Ms. Hurling, when he made that reference to the progress? Page 28. This is, for me, something that we will resolve now. The second paragraph, page 28. South Africa faces no real threat regarding access to European Union markets. Let's tell that to the wine farmers, citrus farmers, and everyone else. Is this the case? Honorable Khadebe?
Chairperson, I think that's the worst threat which is faced by South Africa coming from the EU itself. Because if we can look at all the barriers which the EU put in front of us every year, I think that we have to change our statement, Chairperson. It has to be changed. It cannot be correct the way it's standing.
Can I please have another comment on this? After other members. Is there any other comment from yourself, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable James, Honourable McIntosh? Okay, so you have no problem we can get into the European Union markets, no problem. Oh, that's what you want. It's here, on page 28, the second paragraph. So I want a clear statement here. This is your report, yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, again, as you say, I've only been on this committee for 2 years, maybe 18 months. But I recall that there was a complaint from the EU that we were not finalising our next steps or something. EPA in this area, and that was a complaint, as it were, and that they were putting a shutdown. They were putting on deadline for that. Now, again, I don't know enough about it, and I don't want to make a fool of myself by suggesting something which I know nothing about. So maybe there should be some mention of that.
We've dealt with the EPAs. I'm looking at, when we make a statement like European Union markets, how do you get in if there are non-tariff barriers all over the show? Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Hill Lewis.
I'm thinking that we should create two separate sentences, because I understand the intention behind the message. The one message is the message that South Africa is treated relatively as a developed country. You know, just as one part of the message, relative to how the other SACU members are treated. But then, on the other hand, we do face challenges in terms of accessing markets to the EU. It's just that we must then phrase it such that the proportion and the weight of the statement reflects that, e.g. Is it the oranges, that are facing? So that's my broad proposal. Thanks.
The dairy and a few other things. Honourable Hill Lewis, and closing off with members with Honourable Kadebe.
So just to say, Chair, it's a statement of fact that we have open access to the EU markets in terms of tariffs. We have spoken about SPS and other non-tariff issues elsewhere in the report, so perhaps we can just reference that section. We've dealt with it.
I don't think that's saying it. If I'm holding a gun at your head, and I say, I'm no real threat. And, I already told you why I'm holding the gun. No. Honourable Kadebe?
Chairperson, it shows that we cut from the same cloth. Because that's what I was going to raise. That the EU has treated, I think that this word must be explicit. The EU has treated the members of SACU clumsily. That's why only South Africa was able to send up to 80. So that's why I think that what we must emphasize is that part remains, actually it can even disintegrate the whole union itself. Because if the members are not treated equally, because when they have to know their tariffs, they are common throughout the whole region. So if these members are going to be treated differentially, it's going to create a problem. So I think that aspect that EU put a pazua, I remember the minister was on our side. He said, when I raised it, I said it was not a gun, minister, it was a bazooka on the heads of this guy. No. So I think that part must be covered and be explicit in the report.
Let me turn to yourself, Ms. Hurling.
Yeah, I just want to provide context. The context of this particular statement was made in the, as Honourable Hill Lewis also mentioned, that the EPA, South Africa wasn't initially a signatory. South Africa has a PVCA existing where it's got duty-free on certain products. So if the rest of the SACU countries do not actually sign the EPA, they lose special treatment. But South Africa maintains PVCA. So then you've got the discrepancy tariffs, and the rest of the SACU countries go back to the WTO standards.
also the cost of exporting is raised quite dramatically. So in terms of the threat we're mentioning is in terms of the tariff access, specifically.
But it's only for SACU, not for us. We still maintain TDCS status.
Okay. That's why the reference to no real threat was linked to South Africa in terms of tariff access, specifically. But obviously the SBS issues are still obvious.
At that full sentence. So you go to the next one. However, efforts are being made to preserve the common external tariffs. This is where the progress is being made. You know, that's referred to elsewhere. And minimize, this is a critical point, the differential due to varying rules of origin. Okay? In order to preserve SACU's identity, and to address the legal provisions in the EPA that are problematic. Now, this is where South Africa is coming from here. And it is a sufficiently real threat for Europe to continue trying to engage on the matter. Because, you see, what if you look at SACU, for example, the oldest, the customs union, etc. Who is benefiting from SACU? I mean, we've been down the street before. Pull SACU out, we are the budgets of countries, you know, who are members in this regard, you see. And, you know, the time may come one day when, yes, this evolves and so on and so forth, but you can't evolve on one leg. You need both legs to evolve on this thing. So when you're looking at the TDCA, which is a little bit further down, from that paragraph, it's 1 to the 3rd, we don't know what the TDCA is. It's not written into time in a memorial. It is not. Get that straight. You know, it's something that, yes, it's here for us, etc. It's not here. Things are changing. There is such a rapid change and evolutionary development in trade, and it all depends on the way the world has shifted in the you know, the economic sort of pendulum is moving, that we need to review what is the relationship between the TDCA, SADC, SACU, EU, IPA. It is not that simple. And most unfortunately, if the EPAs move ahead in the manner in which it moved, that it was intended, and probably has changed somewhat, and goes into force, it is going to impact heavily on our arrangements across the border. And the day we come and we want to say, we lift it, we're removing ourselves from SACU, some of us sitting in this committee will be the first jumping up in the House to say, how can you cancel SACU? And yet, who is it serving? We do that because it's better to have regional support and integration than everyone just in the middle of Johannesburg or the middle of Bloemfontein or whatever. We do need to retain that development in other countries on our borders. Right, so all I'm saying, I think that to say South Africa faces no real threat regarding access to European markets is not exactly the situation. We may qualify and say that South Africa is more robust here and others aren't, but we are. We don't just have easy access. The TDCA makes certain access easy. Certain. Where's the dairy products? How much dairy can you get in to Europe? Ask our farmers. Ask, you've all got constituencies in the agricultural areas. Ask them. Yeah. So all I'm saying, can we just not sit, don't talk about no real threat. Maybe you want to use another term instead of threat. You follow? Yes. and then I'll take yourself, Honourable Hilda.
Chairperson, I think that the content advisor has put the qualification to that. I think that it can work for us. South Africa faces no respect regarding duty free. I think now, and then specific now. Yeah, so.
With that one. I'm certainly up here. What about yourself, Honourable Hilders? Now, is that you all prepared to live with that? Okay. Now, you see, we've broken the back there in the ceiling, having thrown out, I don't know what, into the water to catch one little fish. It's like a dynamite or something.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Look, I think that does deal with it. But actually, if you are thinking about ourselves in the EU and SACU, and in fact Africa has trade, and I'm just thinking back where you say this, what I think is important, is on page 15, South Africa should also maintain its role as the leading African trade destination and the gateway to African trade. At the bottom. Now, I think that's a very important statement.
Where are you?
I've got just that sentence at the bottom of page 15, which ties into what it's on regional integration, Madam Chair.
On 15?
On the last sentence at the bottom of 15.
Yeah, well, that wasn't near 28.
I know, but it does have an impact on our relations with the EU. And my concern, Madam Chair, is two things.
Yes.
One is, I think we must in no way not endeavour to meet those hurdles or thresholds that the EU sets, because it keeps us, it enhances our position as the leading African trade destination.
Sure.
And the gateway to African trade. Well, I'd like to talk about the gateway and servant to African trade.
Sure.
So I don't think I'm not suggesting we're lowering our standards,
sure,
but I think we should endeavour to match those standards. But, Madam Chair, there are bigger issues in the world, and one is, and so we've raised my boots on this, it's called global value chains, where you're getting shock absorbers made in South Africa, which are exported to Detroit in the US. We make those platinum things for the exhausts in a huge factory in Durban, and they're exported to around the world. So, you know, my concern, Madam Chair, is that actually the trade is changing, and SACU, which is actually a very old colonial phenomenon, is also going to have to change. And we're going to have to change, and as Africa becomes an increasingly attractive investment destination, we are going to be there. And I don't think we must miss those opportunities. And that's why I'm concerned that we recognize what I would describe as the, I don't know, I must be careful, Mr. Xavier would have a lovely word. But let's put it right, the slightly slippery tactics of saying, well, no, your pork hasn't got enough.
Exactly.
But I don't think we want to lower our standards. I think if they set standards, we must do our best to match them to maintain our position as a leading trading nation.
No, I think when standards are set, they must be by mutual agreement, preferably multilateral. But be that as it may, I think the contributions made in that direction, particular by yourself, Ms. Hurling, just to crack that one, has been extremely helpful. There are no recommendations sent to the Secretary, I'll make that clear. Well, according to the information he gave me, all right, but we're not, Honourable Hillers, you did send some, and between you and Mr. Hermans, you better sort that electronic communication out. The second thing is, I'm not aware that there's anything added to in the conclusion, but the conclusion will come out of different points in the report. But having said that, you see, I can't go and put this on the ATC. I must be frank, I can't. It's not in the position for the ATC. I was hoping it would be, but at the same time, we all agree that this is a very important report. It is a very important report. And what I'm making, I've discussed this with Mr. Hermans briefly. We are here on the 13th. And I believe that what should happen is this. We should clean this up. I do want to see recommendations coming in. I do want to see, you know, any contribution coming in. And that must be in, what is the 11th? It's a Monday. Monday morning, please. And then we'll work together with Mr. Herman on the Tuesday and so on, factoring this in. And what you'll do, Mr. Hermans or Ernie or someone, you'll show where, if recommendations come in, who they're from, so that others know where they've come from. You know how we've done it in the past. It's not going to be major changes because you've all made your notes here. All right? There's only one thing I would like to add and to just indicate our way of having a report that's easier to plow through. I think that and the odd subject here and there would have helped. I'm just simply looking for on page 8, just as an example, not that this may be the one that goes in. But if you simply put in the middle of the page, non-tariff barriers, you know, and break some of this heavy text that we've got pages and pages of. And if you want to see where that is, you come through and see it. So it's just going to be a matter of the layout, a few subheads, the content pages, and your substance here this morning. And I want us, at least on this one, trade, I believe we are at one, broadly speaking, on the trade. Let's leave it there. And I'm now going to close off the trade with your agreement and put it to the 11th and 13th. The 11th for you, the 13th for the committee. Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chair. Can we go back before closing to page 5, the activities of the committee? I think that there's serious omission there. In 2010, the committee members attended the WTO AIDS Ministerial Conference. It was for the first time. Yeah, I think it must be kept shut. Yeah, in December 2010. The portfolio committee members attended the AIDS ministerial conference, which was for the first time that thing happened. And then I'm very proud of that delegation because it gave the European MPs a run for their money. They never forgot us after that. And then number two, Chair, on the very same, on the issue of the 2010, I think that the committee also attended the NECLEC to take a position on the, not precisely on the issue of trade. The committee went to NECLEC to take a position on the 8th Ministerial Conference. Yeah, I think it must be reflected there that it was not haphazard. It was planned for. That's why that the issues which were raised there at the Ministerial Conference was the issue of the consensus reached at the NECLEC level. So by the stakeholders involved, I think it must be kept chat.
I think we, let's just go back through the admin stuff on this and just make sure we've kept all the trade engagements in this regard. Okay. And then I just want to check your mini acknowledgements at this point to make sure you've captured everyone. You start off with Hermans, Herling, Maglani, Clute, right. Then if the members of the committee, pardon? And there's one name that came up was Vito, you know, who's, I think we ought to send him a little note as well. It's been some time since he's been with us. The committee would also like to say a contribution of the minister. I said, in terms of the DTI, please mention the DG and mention people's names here. I think this is a closing report of this period. I want all the names of the committee during this period noted here. Whether you put them on an addendum or what, I want the minister's name put here per se, and the DG per se, and also in particular the DG in this regard. All right? All of the names must be here. Honourable Mabasa.
I'm just wondering, you know, but just to so that we think through together, I'm wondering if we shouldn't also mention the PLO, you you know, the way she is continually with us.
That is an omission we need to also be specific there. People who are here day in and day out, I'm sure that's what we mean, all right? So we put that aside, set that one aside, and members, we're going to take a short tea break before moving in to the PTK, all right? So short tea break, please. Just can we take maybe 5 minutes or so? And there's something, what else is it? You've dealt with the other one, you'll just refer back to it.
You would only hear it from the chair.
I said,
Thank you. my memoirs, I'm going to have a chapter. It's the hardship of my life. The first part of that is I joined it in 1910.
I think we've got to start thinking of just getting back to the committee meeting. We've already agreed that we'll be seeing a few people from finance or the financial institutions one way or the other next week, and that we can't add anything more there. And yet there is also the matter now of the, where is it, the protection of traditional knowledge, which we need to take a decision on as well. Now I'm looking at the relevant people And I know on my left we, oh yeah, there we are, see Dr. James here. Right. And Bosman and Advocate van der Merwe. And my our own staff sitting there at the back. Who's dealing with the PTK here? Is it yourself, Ms. Hurling, or who? Who's dealing with that? Yourself. Right. Honourable Hill Lewis, I know he's just popped out to make a phone call in this regard. Now, where we are is we're actually doing the consideration yesterday. As you know, we were supposed to try and deal with it on Friday, but it didn't seem to suit the prof at that time, Professor O.G. I thought he would be here today, but he's not able to be here, is he, Honourable James? No, all right. Okay. On that particular note then, can we have Advocate van der Merwe? And may I just say, Honourable James, this is the first time I've received this. I didn't have it. I've had my secretary even check my emails. Mr. Hermans told me he never received it. Have you got it? No. You didn't receive it. You've done a double check. I've done a double check. It's dated the 31st. So, unfortunately, everyone's seeing it for the first time. Am I right? Yes, okay. Sorry about that. I didn't get it myself. But are you, do you have one, Honourable van der Merwe, I mean Advocate van der Merwe? You do. All right. So you may have just had a chance to look at it during that extended tea break. So we wanted you to immediately get in with your responses in this regard to complete them, please. Can you do so?
Thank you, Madam James. Yes. Unfortunately, I've not had a chance to read through the whole of the opinion. Scanning it, it seems to indicate the same argument that Professor Dean made last week and that he discussed with me after the meeting. The argument that he made was that the definition, in, especially with reference to both the amendments to the Copyright Act and to the Designs Act, and I'm now talking about IP Laws Amendment Bill because that is the question that was before the committee. I'm not discussing the Protection of Traditional Knowledge Bill at this point in time. I'm simply looking at the IP Laws Amendment Bill. The argument that he made was that where the IP Laws Amendment Bill amends copyright, the Copyright Act and the Designs Act, it will not succeed in protecting traditional knowledge or indigenous knowledge as it is defined in that bill because it requires the work or the design to be new. And the reason for this was because in the definition in the IP Laws Amendment Bill of indigenous work and of indigenous design, there is reference to the definitions used in the Designs Act and in the Copyright Act. His argument is that those definitions, and it seems to me that is how it is set out in the opinion as well, those definitions then, or rather the words are defined. If you then look at those words in the principal acts, there are certain requirements for novelty and newness. Now, I just
stop right there. I'm sorry, Advocate van der Merwe. You know, now that I'm looking at this, I was under the impression here that this was something that was from Mr. Honourable James. Now, the thing is, I've never asked Professor Owen Dean to supply the committee with an opinion, but to give us his responses as your advisor. He's your technical advisor, Honourable James. Isn't that how he came to the committee? But I see here, I'm now requesting him to give us an opinion on this. What we asked Professor Owen Dean was for his responses on this matter. And that is a very big difference. He's not the advisor to the committee in any way, and I must make that clear for the record. The committee did not take a decision. When we get advisors, we have to take a decision on that. Do you understand? It is a process that Parliament conducts. It doesn't just come from my phone call and I breeze up and call a friend. That's not the way it happens. So I must say this is entirely incorrect. And if I get something, if then obviously the committee is fully aware and it goes through that process, and it generally takes 1 week, does not take just overnight. So on this particular basis is, in fact, your material, Honourable James. Because Professor Owen Dean is not here this morning. I understood from what he had to say the last time he was here, he could not next Friday, but he would be here today. Now, but he's not here today to give this. So given that this is the case, I'm correcting this at the outset. It is a response in terms of being the advisor to Honourable James, who tabled this piece of legislation. I want that quite clear. He's certainly not my advisor in this regard, because I would require a process to go to administration and a decision to have been taken in committee. Yes, Advocate Van Merwe.
Madam Chair, may I address you on this question?
You may.
Let me first of all say that the document that you have before you, I asked my assistant to send it through the day it came. She said initially that she had. Mr. Herman doesn't have it on his machine. I've asked her to check again, and she might have not forwarded to you in error. So I apologize for that. Secondly, to say that Professor Owen Dean is not a member of the committee and doesn't entirely understand parliamentary procedures. When he spoke to you, it was his impression that you had asked for this, but he probably misunderstood precisely the nature of the request, because obviously he serves as a legal advisor to me and not to the committee, so you're quite correct. So I just want to place on the record that I will give him the benefit of the doubt for misunderstanding the actual process. So this document that you have before us is my document, not his document, and therefore I should present this document to the committee. The problem is that you haven't edited this document, which places you at a disadvantage as a consequence of the inaction on my administrative machine, so I apologize for that. So I don't know how we should, you have a hard copy in front of you, but you haven't had time to study it. So I'm going to ask, Madam Chair, to take the guidance from you as to how we should proceed, given the circumstances.
Well, let me respond to what you have said here, and I appreciate your clarification. The reality is, most people who come here as advisors to either the department or others seem to have a better understanding of how a committee works. And they're not members of this House at all. So that's the first point. The second point is that this is your document here. Although I've checked with Advocate Van der Merwe, I think in the first instance she said she was familiar with it, and she is now responding. The fact that Professor Owen Dean is not here, as he indicated he was going to be, in fact, that's the very reason I put this at number two, and not number one, because of his challenges in indicating that. He made it clear at the last meeting he could not make Friday, but would be able to make the following Wednesday. This is Wednesday. So if we can just leave that and move on with it. Time is not on our side. I thought I've made that extremely clear. We lost Friday on it. We've actually lost 3 days on this. Not at my request, at the request of your team, Honourable James. And therefore, there is no time. We need to deal with this as effectively as we can. And this is his last comment as in terms of him being your advisor in this particular regard. So what I would appreciate is if Advocate Van der Merwe can deal with this now. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like I've said, just in summary, it appears to me that the document is a similar argument, that because in the IP Laws Amendment Bill, by reference to the definitions in the Designs Act and the Copyright Act, we use those definitions. The argument is that because you use those definitions, if you look at the definition in the Copyright Act and you look at the definition in the Designs Act, there are certain requirements for such a work or such a design. And one of those requirements is that it must be new. Now, my argument to that is that I firstly, I don't agree with that argument. If we look at the And I've done a document where I've done, in the first column, I've indicated what the IP Laws Amendment Bill says. On the first two pages is the copyright, and the second, the third and fourth pages are the designs. And they're exactly the same format. So the first column tells us what the copyright, how the Copyright Act is amended by the IP Laws Amendment Bill. The second column, the middle one, tells us what the Copyright Act says. And then the third one, I've indicated my comments on that. So if we start with copyright, Indigenous work means a literary, artistic, or musical work, and then it goes on. So those are the ones that we are incorporating. Now, if we go to the Copyright Act and we look at the definitions for literary work, artistic work, or musical work, we will see that there's no requirement in that specific definition for newness. You have to go and look at the rest of the Copyright Act to find that requirement. Now, IP Laws Amendment provides for that. In that, in clause, I'm not sure what the clause is, but it says the insertion of the section 28A, where we say subject to provisions of this chapter, and remember that we are inserting a chapter into the Copyright Act with the IP Laws Amendment Bill. The provisions of this Act, and they will refer to the Copyright Act, shall, except insofar as is otherwise provided for in this chapter, and insofar as they can be applied to traditional works. Now, when we look at interpretation of laws, as far back as 1984, we had a case, Canada versus Mount Frere Municipality. I can give the reference if anyone requires that. The court said that a statutory definition should only be applied in such a manner that it would not result in an injustice or incongruity or absurdity. So, and then the court looked at to where the phrase used, unless something is inconsistent, or, so as we are saying here, except insofar as it's otherwise provided for in the said chapter. And in this case, the court found, even if you don't say that, even if you don't say, except insofar as it can be applied, even if you don't say that, a court must look at a bill, at an act, and make sure that the interpretation that it gives is one that is not unjust or absurd. So when we look at 28A, it clearly excludes the Copyright Act, the provisions of the Copyright Act, insofar as they are in conflict with the chapter that deals with Indigenous works. And there is nothing in the direct reading between the definition that we've done for Indigenous works and the reference by incorporation to literary work, artistic work, or musical work that then renders the Indigenous work to be new or novel. Furthermore, on page 2 of that document, or the next page of that document, the word work was also looked at, and we have excluded section 2 of the Copyright Act by adding, where we said work means a work is contemplated in section 2 and for purposes of this act, additional work and Indigenous cultural expressions or knowledge are contemplated in this act. And why did we do that? Because section 2 of the Copyright Act requires that something must be original. So now we have added an extra step with IP Laws Amendment Bill. On designs, exactly the same argument goes. So where an Indigenous design refers to aesthetic or functional, we can look at those definitions. If we look at those definitions in the Designs Act, I'm now on page 3 of that document, we see that aesthetic design and functional design, the definitions, nowhere requires originality. And insofar as the rest of the Act is concerned, that is excluded by the new section 53A, where we say subject to the section, sections, to this section, 53A, and then B up to L, the provisions of this Act, the Designs Act, shall, except insofar as is otherwise provided in the said section, and insofar as they can be applied to traditional designs. So the Designs Act has also been excluded insofar as it would be in conflict with the ethics that deal with Indigenous design. Then another thing that Professor Odin was concerned about was that there's no provision for Indigenous designs to be registered. But that is found in the clause that we're inserting, or the section that we're inserting, 53B, sub 5, where it says an Indigenous community may in the prescribed manner and on payment of a prescribed fee apply for registration of an Indigenous design. So like I say, in summary, to say that the IP Laws Amendment Bill requires that a design or a work must be original, I disagree with that interpretation. I'm of the opinion that that is not in accordance with the normal interpretation rules for interpretation of statutes.
Have you completed what you were saying, Advocate Van der Merwe? Has the advocate's response to what we have heard, all the documents we have received so far, and the clarifications we sought? Honourable James?
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me focus in my response once again on the Designs Act, but I also would like to turn to the Copyright Act. To say, as you know, that aesthetic designs and functional designs are recognized categories of designs in the Designs Act. And what the IPLAB does, it places indigenous designs into one or the other of those categories. The definitions of indigenous designers clearly classes such design as species or subsets of aesthetic or functional designs. What that means, and it's in the document that you have, what that means is that an aesthetic indigenous design must meet the entrance requirements for protection that are applicable to the general category of aesthetic designs under the Design Act. This is consistent with the fact, as it says there, that the probable explanation why IPLAB lays down no special entrance requirements for the registration of indigenous designs. And if you read the following paragraph, the conclusion regarding the entrance requirements for valid registration of an indigenous design, which is to say it must be new and original to qualify for protection, is consistent with 25.1 of the TRIPS agreement by which we are bound. Let me turn to copyright, because the same considerations that have been mentioned in the case of designs apply largely to copyright as well. In order to qualify for copyright, a traditional work must be original, and as we have discussed, folklore and the like cannot possibly meet this requirement. This is well understood. There are, however, fundamental flaws in the trademarks part of the IPLAB as well, and I will outline them as follows. The TRIPS agreement defines the geographical indication as follows in Article 22.1. Indications that identify a good as originating in the territory or member or a region or a locality in that territory where a given quality, reputation, or other characteristic of the goods is essentially attributable to its geographical origin. Please take note that TRIPS says nothing about GIs requiring to have anything to do with traditional knowledge, and this is characteristic of goods when it comes to the concept of GIs. So that, for example, champagne is French, port is Portuguese, sherry is Spanish, as examples of GIs in those countries. Rooibos is the well-known example of South Africa. However, the famous South African wine regions such as Stellenbosch, Paarl, Franschhoek, Walker Bay, Yvelin Arde, and so on are also examples of South African GIs, comparable with champagne, sherry, and port. IPLAB makes provision for the registration of GIs under the Trademarks Act. However, in order to be registrable as a GI, a mark must be a collective mark or a certification mark. Such a certification or collective mark must be specifically designated as a GI. A GI is thus a subset of a collective or certification mark. A geographical indication will be defined in the Trademarks Act after its amendment in the IPLAB to mean essentially what is defined in TRIPS, but qualified by requiring it also to be related to indigenous cultural expressions or knowledge. This latter term is in turn defined to mean essentially that the goods to which the mark is applied must be imbued with local traditional knowledge or culture. Rooibos could probably meet this qualification because traditional techniques and knowledge are utilized in preparing a tea product. However, it is most unlikely that Stellenbosch or any other wine region could meet the qualification. In other words, IPLAB will make it impossible for any of the famous South African wine producing areas, by the way of example of any area names where the relevant product does not embody local traditional knowledge or culture, to be registered as DIs. This is patently absurd and out kilter with what TRIPS envisages as protectable GIs. Indeed, rooibos is the only South African GI that comes to mind that could be registered as a GI under the amended Trademarks Act. IPLAB will exclude from the registration as GIs virtually all the famous South African GIs. Ironically, rooibos has already been comprehensively protected under the Merchandise Marks Act. It doesn't require the Trades Act. It doesn't require IPLAB. It makes the registration as a GI superfluous. The upshot of all of this is that IPLAB practically cancels out the vast majority of South African GIs from being registered as such, and is at variance, and this is really important, is at variance with what TRIPS contemplates. So in sum, we would like to disagree with the advocate, and if I can now turn to Ms. Bosman to add a comment. Thanks.
I just want to get back to the argument that Ankit Sanamadan has given us. Basically summarize what we got from Professor Dean. And I'm going to do it based on the Designs Act. So what we heard from Ankit Sanamadan was that it's not a problem because IP Lab says where there's an inconsistency, the inconsistency, then the IP Lab will trump, and we won't need to deal with new and original as requirements. So taking away new and original as requirements, if that is how you're going to interpret it, that means you don't have to meet these requirements, then the only requirement is what you find in the definition. But what you find in the definition is preceded by an aesthetic or functional design. You can't get any further. You can't get to with an indigenous or traditional origin and traditional character. You can't get to the traditional part without being passed aesthetic or functional design. And those require originality and novelty. But if we are going to argue that it's inconsistent with the IVLAB and with traditional knowledge, then we are going to say that in order for something to qualify as an indigenous design, you need no requirement other than meeting this, what is in the definition. But the courts are going to have to interpret this. And court, as Professor Mahadra said, will not interpret anything which amounts to an absurdity. If you have no requirement for something to be protected as a copyright, as a design, then you are fundamentally going against the very nucleus of the meaning of design, of intellectual property protection, which protects something as a reward for having come up with that innovation or work that's put into it. So court's going to struggle to firstly interpret it. Secondly, they're going to struggle because there's a lot of case law that says if you basically what we're doing here is we're moving away completely, departing from the meaning of design protection. We're completely departing from the premise of it. And courts have interpreted that where you depart from the general meaning of law, it has to be spelled out in the legislation. You have to understand what the legislator has to spell out his intention in this regard. It can't, in this case, it's simply an interpretation by an omission, which in effect has a very, very radical departure from the meaning of IP protection. So the courts aren't going to interpret something as you want to interpret because it will amount to an absurdity, and this is a very big problem that we're sitting with, because that is in effect what we have here.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bosman. Now, do members want to raise any questions or comments before I ask Advocate Van der Merwe to come in? We are going to take you, Honourable James. So we'll take Honourable James first. Honourable James.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to then close on our argument by stating that the key characteristic of the protection of traditional knowledge bill is that it is a sui generis, a tailor-made piece of legislation to protect traditional or indigenous knowledge, and it, as a consequence, does not affect any of the other pieces of legislation that we have in the family of intellectual property law. Therefore, it keeps intact the Designs Act, the Copyright Act, and the Performance Act, and so on and so forth, and therefore does not dilute them. So the sense of the proposal is that it's sui generis, it's standalone, and it's tailor-made to the fundamental qualities of the indigenous knowledge, is that we do not often know who originated it and who introduced the initial design. And as we were trying to argue, the IPLAB provides a vague formulation that will end up in court, and we will see the accumulation of jurisprudence around this of unsolved cases, because the courts won't have good guidance on this. And in that respect, we think that IPLAB is a bad law, and that we are presenting a law that is better, that's tailor-made, and gets around the fundamental problem, which is that to use the existing pieces of legislation, amended as IPLAB tries to do, will nevertheless require a judgment about newness and originality. And I must say the answers we've gotten from Advocate Charmaine Van der Merwe is not reassuring in this respect. Thank you.
Honourable James, can we just check with members if they want to clarify anything further in this regard? We've had the process now for about 3 weeks now, have we not? And this seemed to, we seem to have had a fair amount of convergence on most things, but this particular point, as you know, was highlighted as no convergence on. Do members want to clarify anything in this particular regard with respect to that issue so that Advocate Van der Merwe can respond?
Chair, I think I would just like to hear Advocate Van der Merwe's comment on what Honourable James has just said, that the PT cable is tailor-made to deal with challenges that the IP level doesn't deal with, and that it is standalone and will not in any way affect the other legislation that we have. So I'd just like to hear her comment, and if that is indeed, in her opinion, true. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Honourable Swing. There's just a point I would like here as well. The advisor, Professor Owen Dean, of yourself, Honourable James, the team that you've got, pointed to in his point 13, about section 10.1 of the IPLAB, defines the term traditional design to include indigenous design and a derivative indigenous design, indicating the two different separate distinct types, and they are treated differently in the IPLAB. And he goes on to give an explanation there in his understanding of indigenous design and then the term derivative indigenous design, noting also what the how the IPLAB has defined the latter. Just in this area, if you would comment on what Honourable James has said in this regard, as well as Ms. Bosman, Advocate Van der Merwe, as well as the point I make, because this is the crux of the difference that I see existing here.
Thank you.
Welcome to Member McCarthy. I'm just not sure what committee you're from, Honourable. much. Thank you for joining us this morning. Right, Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Army Laws Amendment Bill, it's quite difficult for me to accept that the Army Laws Amendment Bill is a bill that will not be effective. The committee sat and deliberated on the bill and had experts from the South African Intellectual Property Association, CIPAL, to assist. And the committee received opinions from the various branches of that body in respect of the Army Laws Amendment Bill. So, it's very difficult for me to understand the arguments against it. In relation to the argument that, on a geographic mark, I cannot agree. When we considered geographic marks in the IP Laws Amendment Bill, we made it very clear, and we got opinion from the South African Intellectual Property Association on, I think, specifically from their trademarks section, because I think she was a miss, I'm not sure, she was a professor, Stabangu. She was more on the copyright side of it, so we got a specific opinion on trademarks, and there was no concern given on geographic marks. So, unfortunately, I cannot agree with the argument against it. The relation to the fact that we are dealing with a subset of a design, I again disagree with that argument on the IP Laws Amendment Bill, because we are not. We are excluding it. And if we look at what is the requirement for an aesthetic design, we will see that part of the requirement for an aesthetic design is giving it definition, which is exactly what we've done with Indigenous design. So part of it is, it must be a design that is applied to an article, and then when we look at that article, there must be a pattern or a shape or a configuration or ornamentation or any one or more of these. So there are requirements in the definition as well. And the same goes for Indigenous design. The aspect of new comes with registration, and that is in section 14 of the Designs Act, where it says the proprietor of a design, which in case of an aesthetic design is new and original, and then functional, this and that, can do the following in respect of registration. But for Indigenous knowledge, the IP Laws Amendment Bill specifically provides for registration of Indigenous and derivative Indigenous designs. So this section 14 will not apply. It has been excluded. So I must with respect disagree with that argument. In relation to Indigenous and derivative designs, as I've explained last week as well, a derivative design is the closest that we have to a design as is at the moment. An Indigenous design, and this comes to Member Thring's question as well, we keep on saying that the one is sui generis and the other isn't sui generis, but that is not 100% true. The difference between IP Laws Amendment Bill and the Protection of Traditional Knowledge Bill is that both of them, because they are very similar in what they are proposing in respect of how traditional knowledge or Indigenous knowledge must be managed or protected and administered, registered, all of those things. The concepts are very similar, and both of them are putting in something new in place. And in that respect, both of them are sui generis. The difference is that the Protection of Traditional Knowledge Bill stands on its own two legs, whereas the IP Law Amendment Bill is putting the protection of Indigenous knowledge within each of the relevant current existing IP acts. So that is the only difference between the two. And the Protection of Traditional Knowledge Bill standing on its own, I do think that there are some things that we still need to look at in the current Copyright Act, Designs Act, Trademarks Act, to see whether all of those aspects are fully covered in the Protection of Traditional Knowledge Bill. But other than that, both can work. I can't say to the committee otherwise. Both can work. The question for me is more whether the committee wants to do a standalone bill or bring it in under the current IP law. And in that regard, the trading industry made a comment that I thought quite valid. In fact, it was a comment that did not come up during the deliberation on IP Law's amendment bill. But I thought, wow, this is quite a something to think about. Where she was making the comment that with certain marriages and so on, because it was separate, dealt with separately, you lose out on aspects of the law as is in existence. And that was the reason for, part of the reason for bringing it in under the current laws. It made a lot of sense to me. On the other hand, having a standalone bill does give you certain freedoms in the sense that members of the public who will look at what is applicable will only go to one document. That is true. We can't get past that. But that is not for me to make a decision for the committee. But what I can say to the committee is that both of these bills, like I said, I would like to add something to the protection of traditional knowledge bill, just to give it the full protection that is currently provided in copyright, design, trademark. But both of them are quite valid, and both of them will, in my opinion, be able to protect traditional knowledge or indigenous knowledge, depending on the bill that you're talking about.
No, thank you very much. We appreciate that response. You know, members, I've been here going over, being a pain to go over the work with Mr. Hermans as well here. This is not something that we can keep as what is called a running deliberation or a running document. We are obliged to come to a position sooner or later on this matter. Now, what I do want to do is because one wants to just go through a few points so that you hear where we're coming from, and then just get Mr. Hermans to maybe just print out something or other with, you know, a change here and there that may have been inserted. Because what we have is we had a bill tabled. The bill that was tabled here was actually introduced on the 17th of April, 2013. At a hand there, because I'm actually trying to sum up the process now. Honourable James?
You can just give me one last opportunity. And also, Ms. Barfan, let me just say just two things. First is that I would argue to my colleagues here is that the traditional knowledge bill will work properly, and the IPLAB will plunge all of the intellectual property laws that we have into uncertainty and into a string of government cases. You've heard all the arguments. Let me just say that. And if you stick to the IPLAB, we can talk again in 4 years' time and see what happened to our IP system. The second point I want to make is that you will remember all the submissions. The majority of submissions support the sui generis. The opinion that I read to you from Professor Owen Dean is shared by Judge Harmsa and the entire intellectual rights community in the country. But the really important point I want to make is that the custodian of traditional knowledge in our country is the Department of Science and Technology. The Indigenous Knowledge System is part of DST's task, and DST supports the sui generis approach to traditional knowledge. Ms. Bosman?
Thank you, Honorable James. Ms. Bosman? Like you, I'm also just hearing that, all right? Please go ahead.
Thank you. Just to touch on your question about derivatives, further, call it an incongruence, if we're going to interpret things to exclude new and original. Section 53B of the IPLAB reads, the author of a derivative indigenous design, which is A, new, and B, has features which are based on or derived from an indigenous design of an indigenous community, may in a prescribed manner and payment prescribe the pay registration for the registration. This sets out a requirement for a derivative. why didn't I have a requirement for an indigenous design? If the intention was that it would new and original would not apply, surely a court would interpret in such a way that it expressly gives us the requirements. Otherwise, there are no requirements, and that goes fundamentally against the grain of Ivy's petition. Thank you.
Kit Vandermeer, you've heard what Ms. Bosman is saying. It's a pertinent point. Please respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. In that same section, 33B, sub 5, it deals... 53. in that same section, 53B, that deals with registration, sub 5 indicates an indigenous community may, in a prescribed manner and on payment of the prescribed fee, apply for registration of an indigenous design. And the indigenous design is defined, and that is where you will find those requirements.
You know, for those of us who went through the IGLAB, I think, were you with us at the time, Honorable Hilda? No. But Uncle James, I think you were, weren't you? No, okay. Well, look, I mean, you're very au fait with it, put it that way. But it does seem that those of us sitting here who were on it rings familiar at that point in time. We went through this repeatedly. It was one of these pieces of legislation that took so long. I think we had more consultants than with any other piece of, other than the Companies Act, the CIPCO. And in particular, we tried to take account of some of these issues, the very one you brought up. Because this was a thorny issue. That's the reality, even in the subcommittee itself. It was a really thorny issue on this, with the professor, Shibungu, coming in and giving us a position. And there were four of them at that time. I recall there was some professor from Natal as well. You may recall him. Yes. Now, we spent a lot of time on in this area for the very reason you're saying. What we were not happy about originally was, well, the derivatives seem to be not sufficiently protected. Should we go this route? How do we address the issue in definitions? And in the end, we had to change a number of issues in this regard. So it's one area that we are quite familiar with. Notwithstanding that, it's quite clear, Honorable James, Professor Owen, I'm looking at the point being made here, that even as we sit here today, there isn't an agreement on that issue. That's how I'm hearing it. There doesn't appear to be an agreement, even as I sit here, Chairing. Now, we've tried to get an agreement here on this, from Mark's building to here and so on, and I don't see it coming. I certainly wanted to pursue this to a point where there was full congruency, as it were. But there comes a time when you have to acknowledge there's not going to be a full congruency. There's not going to be a complete consensus. Now, I've said, given that this is the case, I'm going to just allocate, because I need to speak to staff on the matter as well, a short 5-minute adjournment. Honourable McIntosh also asked if he could be back for the vote. I'm not going to wait indefinitely for him, but I do try to accommodate all members of the committee, you know, who participated in the process. So I want you, it's just 10 to 12, to please just adjourn 5 minutes. I'm staying right here. So that we put something together, and you're also able to talk to each other on the matter. Please work together, get any clarifications you want to get. I want to see Mr. Inkwane here, please, from DTI. We want to reconvene in the next minute. All members sitting down, I don't know who's missing at this particular point in time. They're going to be arriving back any minute. I asked Mr. Nkwana, unfortunately, I'm not too sure. I know that you're not the DDG there. You're not the chief director in that. But are there two chief directors in that division? Director, sorry about that. I didn't have your details. The Director, Commercial Law and Policy. Yes, you have been with us over the last 4 years on this issue. Thank you. He just wishes to put the input of the DTI on before we take the matter further. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, questions have been raised, and I think Advocate Van der Merwe clarified a lot. So at the risk of distorting what is said, because I think she simplified everything, so if I'm to try and simplify further, I'll end up messing everything up. Chair, just to respond to a few issues, the IPL Amendment Bill is actually meant to benefit communities, so there's a criteria which needs to be met, so they should be working together with the community. They should be prior informed consent, and they should be benefit sharing. So when all that is in place, the community and the person who is investing with the community will get to benefit. But the main issue is that we are not really into registering pure indigenous knowledge. We are not for that. We are for getting benefits flowing through derivative works. So even under the copyright regime, as we have it currently, one can use existing works and get protection through that. But the existing works, which won't be new, if you use your current copyright act now, or legislation, to come up with something which is in existence, the more changes you make to it so that it's drastically different from what is known to be in industry, means that you still qualify for originality. So works will be made by people, and they'll come up with derivative works which are entirely meant to benefit the communities. So the pure indigenous knowledge, we're really not into it in terms of trying to make sure that people benefit out of it directly. It will only be in our databases as the discussions over the previous year, so that we can compare and look at to as whether there be any consultations. With regard to trademarks, the Trademarks Act as we have it currently looks at certification marks and collective marks, as it was correctly indicated. Most of the ways in which things are done, actual traditional, I don't think we can go back to the definition. We've spoken about it, the definition of indigenous knowledge or traditional knowledge. It doesn't really have to be hundreds of years old. It's a way in which people are doing things, so it becomes a traditional way of delivering. We've got a number of cases which were presented before this house. What is in point is your draconium from the Eastern Cape, which was registered. This is under the patent regime. So why not use have copyright in such processes as they are covered under the patent act, and also give a name to these products under the trademark act, so they would actually meet all the requirements, because many jurisdictions around the world are using bits and pieces of this in the different IP legislation which they have. But there's no country which we can agree that has taken all the IP legislation. But when we started those process, we got comments, and was an overwhelming support for the bill. So there was an overwhelming support for the policy and the bill. We got comments from as far afield as Australia and Malaysia. We got a lot of people supporting the bill, and we're still getting a lot of articles from people who are actually in support of the bill and the approach we're using. So we're sticking to intellectual property, because the intellectual property laws as they are now currently actually being used to misappropriate the knowledge and benefit other people. So our view is that let's continue, let's have the intellectual property laws used to benefit the communities. Why is it good when it happens, when it's misappropriated, we don't complain, but when we try to benefit the originators of the knowledge, then it becomes a problem. With regard to the issue of DST, supporting a sui generis, I think there's nothing wrong with that. It's within their mandate. Our mandate is intellectual property. So DST will definitely support a sui generis system within their mandate. But we always work together, even at WIPO. They do support the IT system under the sphere of government. But there's a different department. Their mandate is to look at sui generis. With regard to all this, I think we just need to focus on the fact that we are looking at what the Patent Laws Amendment Bill laws of 2006 did. So this is merely a follow-up in concluding the whole process. So therefore, I think that's our input, and would really appreciate that we can get to protect the communities and get to benefit them going forward using the current IT system. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ankana. Well, now, members, I asked for that input to just make the position clear. It's not up to me to make the position clear of DTI. They needed to have said someone in this regard. Honourable James, we've heard the arguments you've put forward on the bill that was tabled here. We've spent a lot of time on this bill. as I said earlier on, it was last week, we need to come to a conclusion on where we're going with this bill, which would have been Friday, which is now today. So members, I think Mr. Kermans, as you know, the committee secretary, to go and draft the beginning here of this, just to, we had a rolling document prepared, and we've now reached towards the end. Well, in fact, the end in terms of 90% of the report before you take a decision. The report of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry captures what we've done. I'm not reading first part again, but simply the note. The bill was introduced and referred to the Portfolio Committee Trade and Industry for consideration and report on the 17th of April, 2013. In compliance with the interim measures for the introduction and consideration of private members' bills, the committee provided reasonable notice to the member who introduced the bill, Dr. Wilmot James, to brief the committee on the 12th of September 2013 on the content of the introduced bill. On the 12th of September, the committee took a decision to request Dr. James to comment on the submissions received on the bill and brief the committee on the 18th of October 2013. On the 25th and 29th of October 2013, as well as the 1st of November 2013, the committee considered the submission that were received on the bill and that was published in the Government Gazette. During the deliberations, the committee considered the merits of the bill. After considering the submissions received, there was only one submission, which, as I said to Mr. Hermans, we had to note that we took a decision on. You'll remember the National House of Traditional Leaders, which was a submission received, but not in the correct manner, not on its, you know, its own legal head. As it were, legal letterhead, and it wasn't signed, and it was sent back. That should be noted as well here. It was part of our work. Despite our emails, we have not heard any, we have not received a document back, and we had to receive information in that regard. They are not yet in a position to respond at all, having not actually sent the first document. During the deliberations, the committee considered the merits of the bill. After considering the submissions received and after further deliberations on the bill, the committee concluded, and these are important, A, the protection of traditional knowledge is not uncompetitive. B, traditional knowledge should be protected under the umbrella of intellectual property. And C, the bill and the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Bill both seek the protection of traditional Indigenous knowledge, with the Protection of Traditional Knowledge Bill favouring a stand-alone bill. The initial draft of the Protection of Traditional Knowledge was submitted for consideration by the committee during the call for submissions on Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Bill. In its report on the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Bill, dated the 19th October 2011, the committee rejected an amendment moved by the Democratic Alliance, the Economic, I mean the Inkatha Freedom Party, and the Freedom Front Plus, that the Department of Trade and Industry should submit a new sui generis bill dealing solely with Indigenous knowledge. The committee is still of the view, and this is where you need to know. Now, I want to know if the committee is still of the view that the IPLAB, which incorporates the protection of Indigenous knowledge into existing intellectual property legislation, is the correct approach. That is the decision we took in October, 19th October 2011, on a bill that was before us and was adopted in the House. And that is as far as we have on this, other than to say we need to take the final decision here. Now, I just need a minute here. And I need to put the question to you. Having heard all the arguments here, and really we've got to apply our minds at this point, all of us. In applying our minds, we need to be aware of the implications of that decision. Having looked at the bill, heard what has been said, deliberated on the matter, does the committee consider it desirable to move forward with the bill? In other words, you've considered the bill, having considered the desirability on the subject matter of the bill in terms of the interim measures for the introduction and consideration of private members' bills, we need to know what your position is. Do we have someone to propose that we take the protection of traditional knowledge bill forward and we say it is desirable? There have to be some people who agree on that because this was tabled in this committee by the people concerned. So let's see if we do have someone to propose that. Honourable Hill Lewis, you propose that we find this desirable, protection of traditional knowledge bill. Do you have a seconder? Does it have a seconder? Honourable Thring seconds that. Okay. Do we have another proposal on the matter? Honourable Becky Khadibi?
Honourable Chair, I'd like to move that this bill is not desirable to be taken there, as the conditions which were prevailing when we adopted the initial intellectual property laws amendment bill have not changed. That bill had the support of the National House of Traditional Leaders. We consulted widely about it, not only the national experts, also the international experts. I think that it is not desirable. This bill is not desirable. So the issue of intellectual property laws amendment bill must remain on track, and this one of the protection of traditional knowledge bill must not be taken any further. We reject it as it stands. Thank you.
Does that proposal have a seconder? Honourable Wabasa?
Chair, I second Honourable Hadeva's proposal.
There are two proposals on the table. I have, as requested by the Honourable McIntosh, that's why I delayed things a little. I did wait until 12. It is now past 12. I can't wait any longer. So we will now take a vote on the first proposal. That is the proposal by the Honourable Hill Lewis. Can we see by a show of hands supporters for that proposal? We have the Honourable Thring from the ACDP, we have the Honourable Hill Lewis from Democratic Alliance, we have the Honourable James from the Democratic Alliance. Now can we see, show of hands, those in favour, against. Those who are against that one, right, it's Honourable Kwabasa, Honourable Khadebi, Honourable Waili, Honourable Mabasa, and Honourable McCarthy. Right. And that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 opposed to it. That's the first one. I think this accounts for everyone, therefore there can't be any abstentions. You know, I mean, we count for every member sitting here. All right, there were no abstentions. Then the second, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Can I just ask who the sixth person voting against was? And then just to ask, for a clarification on the rules on whether a member of parliament who's not a member of the committee is allowed to vote here?
I think that is an important point. Mr. Hermans?
As the member is a member, but is a constant member in place of Mr. Swanepoel, she would be allowed to vote in the committee in terms of the National Assembly rules. Nothing prevents any member of the committee, two COP members, to create a quorum or vote in the absence of the member of the full member.
Chair, I would accept that if the member is a co-opted member, then they would have the right to vote. However, the process in terms of the co-option, whether it needed to be done, or has it already been done, or should it have been done in this meeting?
Give me a minute there. I think to avoid a delay in this regard, because I'm sure we'll find the relevant place, but time is marching on in this direction. And we can certainly, we had no problem in terms of the voting.
Honourable Chairperson.
I'm just coming to read it out. The co-option, when members and alternates are not available, full members, if a member of a committee and that member alternate are both absent from a committee of meeting of the committee, the chairperson may co-opt any other assembly member to act as a member of the committee until that committee member or the alternate member is no longer absent. Now, I want you to recall that in terms of the IFP position with one of the bills that was taken here, when a decision taken when the Honourable Ariane Ambrosini was away on medical leave, I was requested by the IFP to have somebody else in who was not the alternate. Do you follow? Because the alternate hadn't been replaced and the full member wasn't here. And that particular member who later spoke in the House on the debate voted. Do you recall that? You were present here. So this is not something that hadn't been exercised before, and I need to make that clear. But the reason I delayed it is to get the rule. This is a bill going through. The bill that has been dealt with here. And I don't want to slip up on the rules. All right? So now that's clear. I hope so. Fine. And I think we learned from yesterday, I'm not familiar with the rules. Yes.
Can I have a clarification of the result? I'm not sure that it was 6-3. I think it was 5-3.
We did have a clarification there. Those who supported your proposal was the Honourable Thring. I called out the party, the name and the party, yourself, the Honourable Hill Lewis, and the Honourable James. Those were the names I called out. And I gave the parties. Those who supported was the Honourable Kwabasa, the Honourable Khajebi, the Honourable Waiili, the Honourable Mabasa, the Honourable Makasi. Right? And then that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Hildewis. Okay. Now, we move into the next point. No, I'm in the middle of the vote right now, Honourable McIntosh. Yes. Yes, well, that's where we were. Now, for the second proposal. We're voting on the second proposal. That was the one you proposed, Honourable Khadebi. Those in favour, please raise your hands.
Chair, I'm now back in.
Yes, and you can raise your hand.
No, can you read out the proposal, please?
I think only Hill-Lewis appreciates that joke. But, yes, the proposal was made by the Honourable Hill-Lewis in your absence that we accept and we find the bill, the PTK, desirable. And there was a vote which you've just heard the result of. There was a counter-proposal from the Honourable Khadebi that we reject that and the bill, that it's not desirable. So that's where we are now. So that's why I smilingly said you may raise your hand. Obviously, I wouldn't do that. You know, that is a proposal on the table. Please raise your hands, those who support the proposal that says the bill is not desirable on the table. The Honourable Kwabasa, Honourable Khadebi, Honourable Waiili, Honourable McCarthy, Honourable Mabasa, all of the African National Congress. Right. Those against this proposal. Okay. Honourable Singh, the ACDP, Honourable McIntosh from COPE, Honourable Hill-Lewis from the Democratic Alliance, Honourable James from the Democratic Alliance. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Right, now those are the results. Can you tell us the way forward? Is there any... As some of you may know, you do have the opportunity. The vote is in favour of the bill, Protection of Traditional Knowledge Bill, is not found desirable, and so therefore it is rejected by the committee. However, if you do not reject that, you know who you are, you may put forward your minority opinion. And the minority is on the basis that you did not win, you know, the argument. So it's one member per party. All right, Honourable Hill-Lewis, followed by the Honourable McIntosh.
If it's one member per party, I wonder whether the bill's proposer shouldn't do so on behalf of the DA.
The Honourable James can do it. I just thought that seeing as he had tabled the bill, you may wish to have gone with it. That's all. But okay. I mean, it's entirely up to you. Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Chairperson, the minority view of the DA is as follows. We believe that sufficient argument has been made in this committee such that the protection of the Traditional Knowledge Bill is desirable and that the IPLAB is in fact a damaging bill for South Africa.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill-Lewis from the Democratic Alliance, Honourable COPE, McIntosh from COPE.
Madam Chair, as a person who actually studied social anthropology and has a passionate interest in indigenous knowledge, trees, I hope Marula was brought in. Sure. I am deeply disappointed that rationality hasn't prevailed. From the COPE perspective, I thought the IPAB bill was a big step forward. But after listening to all the evidence, and this isn't a political bill, I decided that a sui generis bill was a much more appropriate way, and it would add luminance to South Africa's reputation in terms of intellectual property rights and indigenous knowledge at international level. And to me, it's a bill which we should actually, all right, sure, we may refine it, but we should be supporting this bill, not saying it's undesirable. In my view, this bill is highly desirable.
Thank you, Honourable McIntosh. Honourable Thring.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The minority opinion of the ACDP, having heard the arguments for both IPLAB as well as the PTK bill, is that both have sufficient information within them, processes, instructions, guidelines within them to do the same thing. However, the opinion of the ACDP is that what would move us in favor of the PTKB bill is that it is standalone, sui generis, and just makes it easier. It's an easier process, and it's for that reason that the ACDP supports it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Thring. I think we're only capturing the minority position, you see, in the report, if you recall. Do you want to comment, Honourable Khabibi?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that, Chairperson, I'll have to voice my opinion on this whole process of this bill. I think that as an African child who was born in South Africa under apartheid, I felt during the process of the processing of this bill that I was taken back to that years, whereby as an African child, I was not considered a human being. Right now, Chairperson, in your presence, Honorable McIntosh said Honorable McCarthy is a voting cattle. It's an insult. He said that now. And Chairperson, we didn't say anything about that. It's highly disappointing. It's highly discriminatory. It's insulting. Don't say that.
Well, put your hand down. Because in the first instance, I did not hear what you said. That's why I'm asking the Secretary what is being said. You so often speak in the vernacular that I don't always get it. Honourable Khadevi.
So basically, Chair, she has been referred to as an animal. She has been referred to as an animal in the New South Africa where there is a constitutional democracy. This thing, Chairperson, this thing didn't start here. Ne? I referred some time back to you to an article on Cape Times where Professor Owen Dean referred to the portfolio committee which was dealing with this bill as an indifferent portfolio committee. So by saying that it was indifferent, he simply meant that it didn't apply its mind. But he confirmed that later when he said that the issues of intellectual property laws is above us. So it means that we are intellectually inferior as the people who are dealing with that. Chairperson, that's an insult. I think that it must be on record that this thing has happened in this committee. And I think that it must be explicit in the report as it goes to Parliament that an advisor of DA has said that. Please, I want that thing to be on record.
I'd rather deal right now. And I think it's a problem when members of the House and members of a committee, having made statements that are then referred to, walk out before they are dealt with. It's becoming a tendency in this Parliament for people to do that. And it is wrong. It may not be printed in black and white, but it is wrong in any democracy to do that. Because what you're doing is insulting the committee as well as the chair. Because I do want to make a ruling, and I made it clear, having interrupted you, Honourable Khadevi, I did not hear that. But like I say, there are lots of vernacular terms that are used here, and this is why I checked with Mr. Hermans. If what was said, and I'm going to look at Hansard in this regard, that is the most serious insult, and I'm going to ask the Speaker to take action on it. To refer to a member of this committee as voting cattle, then, and he did not disagree when he had the opportunity, however, if I'd like to just finish, Honourable Khadevi, I will give you an opportunity. I can understand why you are expressing the points you have made. We've never had that. Never since I became a public rep in 94. And honorable, my boss is sitting there at the same time as me in the same legislatures when there was a lot of racism. Have I ever heard this? Ever. And if that is what was said, I take the strongest objection, the strongest. And I shall argue, write a letter to the Speaker asking him to deal with this matter in our Parliament itself. Honourable Kateri, followed by Honourable James.
Honourable Chairperson, he didn't say it in the microphone, so you might not capture it in the Hansard. But what is also critical is that he said it in English. He didn't say it in the Negro. Yeah, Hansard. Yeah, he said they brought in the voting kettle. He said they brought in the voting kettle. He was speaking with Mr. Tring. He was speaking to him. We could hear that. So it's very insulting that an African is still called a cow in their own country.
Honourable James.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to refer to my colleague's reference to the approach taken by Professor Owen Dean to this committee when he made that remark that in speaking to the advocate from the Merwe, that these matters are over people's heads. I was taken aback by that, and I was embarrassed by that. And I mentioned that to colleagues going to the elevator. And I make no excuse for it. It's a kind of legal arrogance, in fact, that came with it, you know, and a presumption. And I'm also not an attorney. I'm also not a lawyer. And often things are over my head. But the way in which you said it, I can understand why you would take offense. So I do. And I'm just not making excuses about that. So I just wanted to put that on the record that I believe that his approach was one that was actually regrettable, and I'm sorry about that. That nevertheless, it's important to note that the substance of what he had to say for the benefit to this committee. I also want to say that I'm also an African child. And so is everybody. And that to the extent that he spoke over the head of the committee, he spoke over the head of the entire committee that includes me. So I would not like this to be racialized, but I just wanted to say that I was embarrassed by that. Thanks.
I think we've got to separate the two points, and I regard the second one far greater, impact. And that is why I must deal with it as a chairperson, and I'm going to take it further. Yes, Honourable McCarthy.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was also embarrassed, but I defended myself because I could hear nobody was responding. I had to respond back that don't dare tell that I'm a voting cattle. I am not a cow. I am not an animal. So he said so, and I responded to him. Thank you.
Moment in time, it's the first time we've had an incident like that in this committee. And it shows, I don't know what it shows, but you've indicated what you thought it reflects, Honourable Khadebe. I must say, it makes me feel politically weary when I hear that, to think so much has changed and so much has not changed. But I would like us rather to get back just to the committee issues. I, on behalf of the committee, Honourable McCarthy, I apologise. I want to just take us forward to what has to be dealt with because this is next week now. And Mr. Hermans is probably in a far better position to capture those points.
Chairperson, for next week the committee meeting will take place on Wednesday the 13th, where we have submitted an invitation to the Reserve Bank as a National Treasury to brief the committee or give input on the National Credit Amendment Bill. We will also look at the program going forward for the first quarter of 2014. I think we'll also provide a status report of the committee's annual plan, what has been done, what has not been done, and also provide deal with all outstanding minutes up to that date on the 13th. The venue will be communicated to members because we're trying to get a bigger venue for that particular meeting.
The meeting is adjourned.